Welcome to the J3 University Podcast. I'm your host, John Jewett.
And I'm your co-host, Luke Miller.
Our mission is to elevate the physique coaching standard
and deliver the highest level of competitors to the stage.
Let's jump into today's episode. Creating the worst physique coach. That's what Luke and I are going to make today. Okay, so we don't want to make terrible physique coaches, but we know that there is, unfortunately, poor coaching out there. And in the day and age right now, coaching that is not up to par is just getting exposed. And there's a few standouts that Luke and I are going to go through today to make a great physique coach. So things that we're seeing that might not be getting done that can really elevate your level of coaching and bring more results out of your clients. If you're not doing these, it might make you in the category drop down to being a bad physique coach. So we don't want that for you. So we're going to go through some points and dress out a few that might stand out of some issues where you could up your game.
Yeah, I think my biggest one, and the one that I've seen, honestly, probably the most feedback recently of like some of the clients onboarded over the last 9 months, like drastic changes in their process, is overviewing training videos, which to me is wild that people don't, because training is the core stimulus for hypertrophy. And if you're not having an athlete development process as a part of your coaching in the skills of training, you're doing a disservice and actually putting a glass ceiling on your clients for how far they would progress. So I think it would be smart, maybe just within like saying that, we start to lay out some expectations around training videos and clients sending training videos to coaches, kind of what that looks like. And, you know, maybe expectations the coaches can have for the clients as well, in regards to doing that.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, training is the greatest stimulus that's going to change physique. So we could have the perfect plan on paper given out to a client of, you're going to have your back day, you're going to go do pull downs, then a row, then whatever. And you have this in your mind as a coach of how that should look and what that stimulus per set's probably going to deliver. And if you never see it actually done, it could be completely different. Even how someone interprets an exercise as a coach, if you even write it a little bit differently, I've seen that happen, and have it happen to myself where there's some exercise and they come back, you're like, man, that's not even the right exercise that you're doing. So I think, you know, for one, having good notes on your exercises you're going to have them do could circumvent a little bit of that. And also, you know, technology's come a long way. So coaches of the past that have been stuck in the past technology way, like, come to the forefront, because there's so many greater opportunities now with what we have to advance and be able to review training footage. Because before, like, man, to send a video to a coach, say 10 years ago, like, how are you going to do that? Like, with even phones, how they're set up now, you know, we didn't have like, even like Google Drive wasn't even as extensive. So we now have the technology capability to quickly send video files over. So this isn't quite an issue, but we do have like coaching systems that we use, like Luke and I, we use Kahunas. And in our exercise programs, we have videos of us doing the lifts. So immediately a client can look at the lift and see, oh, okay, this is how it should be executed. They don't have to jump out of the coaching app either, because I've seen that kind of be a hurdle as well. With a lot, what we used to do is upload all your exercise index to YouTube as private, and you'd have links off your training program. They have to click the link, then go view it, then go back to their program. Then they might be logging in something else. It's kind of a mess. So with Kahunas, like, it's consolidated it all for us and what we're using in J3U coaching. So I think, for one, trying to set up a system that can already circumvent a lot of your corrections to where you're being more time efficient as a coach. Now, Luke, to actually get some initial cueing off the videos, what are you setting for clients expectation wise to do? Like, are you, hey, like, send me all your videos, or do you have set amounts or certain exercises? Like, what's the initial that you set up for your client?
Well, yeah, to kind of preempt that as well, I think one cool thing we're doing with J3U coaching is we have the exercise database, like the full logs of all of the demo videos within the program, to show like the exercise that's being written and kind of how to execute it and things like that, to kind of help circumvent that process. I do try to keep it to a limit of videos per week for two reasons. One, to keep the efforts focused of actually applying what the feedback and the critiques are, because I think if you send like 30 training videos, not only is that like a ton of training videos to go through in a single check-in, but it's also like, how do you implement all of the changes across all 30 videos within a week? Like, change doesn't happen easily. So for the client, being able to make skill transfer easier, you're focusing on less things per week so that it starts to kind of cross transfer, right? Like if you drive cueing for a squat pattern with foot pressure, you can kind of teach them how that would transfer into their leg presses and their other squat patterns. And then they can start to be aware of this. And then it kind of just fixes it across multiple. So I do keep a 10 training video limit per week. And then I do typically assign body part specific. So if you have a client with weakness through quad development and chest development, I say, hey, let's work through all the quad and chest exercises first, and then you can go through the rest of the body parts as you see fit. And so that way we're kind of hitting the priorities first, and then we're kind of organizing it in that way. But I do really like keeping it at about 10, just because I've seen implementation on the client side go a bit smoother when they're limited in how many they send, just from not being overwhelmed from all the changes and critiques that you're sending them throughout a check-in.
Well, and it's just a reasonable, even coaching wise, right? You're like, oh yeah. Are you turning into a bad coach because you don't want to see all the videos? It's like, no, even if you had like 20 clients and they all sent you 10 videos, you know, that's like a ton of videos to go through. Like, it just wouldn't be manageable. So, and I you make a great point as far as like actual retention. Because if you're reviewing like 30 exercises, most of them are not taking notes and then going to the gym with their notes and implementing it. So it's like trying to get the most from the least initially. Yeah. And I do something similar to you. Like, body part specific is great. If it's more generalized, I'll say, hey, each training day, let's first start with the first two compound movements, because those are your like your big bang for the buck exercises. Uh-huh. Send me work sets, and I only need a 15-second clip of the last like working reps. And then once I say, okay, this one's good, we check that one off. If it's one that I give cueing to, I'll say, repeat that one and send it back to me the next week. And that way we can completely check it off by the second week with like any final cueing. Then we move down the list of exercises till eventually we get to isolation, which usually are not a big deal. It's usually your compound lifts where you have to really focus those on. And the last point is to, I wouldn't make assumptions as a coach just because you have a pro level athlete coming in, because, and I've said this before, like even at my own level, I make mistakes in training or form has slipped over time. And then I have to review footage to be like, okay, this needs to get like dialed in a little bit tighter. Also just assuming maybe they haven't had a second eye on them either. So just because a high level athlete's coming to you, don't assume that they know how to do everything perfectly. They're hiring you to coach them. So still review all that footage with them so you can uphold them to the standard that you do want. And also you can monitor just training effort, fatigue, like all those things that could come out of seeing them actual training.
Yeah. And I think that's, go ahead.
No, I was going to mention like, I think this is an overview a little bit of what makes a great coach. And I know we look at all these like guru coaches, right, that are coaching some of the best athletes, and what are they like? They're in person with a lot of these clients, which that's the limitation of being online. So it's, how can we create as much of a hands-on process with an online coach that's within reason before you're actually like in person with someone? But yeah, go ahead.
No, I just think those are the main tenets for training footage. I do think the last piece I do like is prep work footage being sent, just because sometimes movement quality is what drives the execution issues. And so if you've mapped out, hopefully, prep work for them to do to address that, I do think that that needs to be a part of the video review, because most clients coming in haven't probably done session prep work. And so I think that's an aspect to cover as well within the training footage, kind of before we dive into that next point of contention within, you know, coach development.
Right on. No, it's just part of your assessment process, right? Like,
yeah.
And off the front end, you should have some movement assessments take place. And that might spur on, be like, oh yeah, we should see what this person's doing before their actual training, Some people don't need anything done. Some people do. So it's all dependent, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Getting to our second point as what makes a bad coach is only allowing written email communication.
Communication, yeah.
And, there's coaches, maybe they are successful like that, but in general, I think it can be a limiting factor. Just because I've seen how varied some people can communicate. I've had some people that can communicate very well in the written form, and you can really read it like it's them telling you to it and be concise enough with that information. But also some people in the written form really condense down. I think this is more of a case now with our current just communication standpoint in texting, is that everything's like as quick as you can say something. And so it dilutes a lot of the meaning, and you're not able to pull out some of the even subjective and emotional things that you could pull out. Say for if we're speaking with one another, like, hey coach, I'm really tired today. Or is it, hey coach, I'm so tired today. Or, hey coach, I'm a little tired today. Like all those would have like, you could pick up on different, like just emotion in that, be like, all right, this chirpy guy that's saying he's tired doesn't sound very tired. And so like that could be an instance. So you wouldn't get that just off an email. So I think being a little bit diverse and flexible for the range of client that you're going to have, and not set in your own ways, because improving communication with that client is going to allow you to improve your assessment of what's occurring at that check-in process. And if you have a more accurate assessment, you're going to make more accurate decisions in where you're taking the program for them, and then getting better results in turn. So what I do, and it varies, some people only, they don't want to do voice memos, and that's perfectly fine. So I'll have that flexibility though. So some people I say, hey, you need to send me a 3-minute voice memo, no longer. So I do put a limit on that, because I've had people send me podcasts that are like 10 minutes long. Like, we don't need to talk this long about a check-in. So think about it too, where an athlete doesn't realize, like, if you had 40 clients check in for that day and they all send you 10-minute videos, this is 400 minutes of you sitting there, and is completely unreasonable. So limit it. Say, hey, 3-minute voice memo or 2-minute tops of anything that's not you're able to communicate in the typed normal check-in. Some people might be able to do that through a Loom video, so where you can actually see like facial expressions. But again, set your time limits to them, and also training them on what type of feedback's important and what's not. And that's your job as a coach. Because I've heard coaches complain like, oh man, this guy just rambles on about his dog got sick and what the dog ate and had to go to the vet and get this. And like, I don't care about any of that. I was like, well, you need to communicate that to your client of like, hey, my dog got sick and that's why my sleep was interrupted. Not all the extra nuance that went on to it. So it's your job as a coach to help foster what they're communicating, so they realize what's important and they realize what is not important.
Yeah, I'm gonna give an example for people to kind of understand this a bit more. One of the things I love about coaching coaches is they're really good about upholding their end of that two-way street of communication typically. I have a client, Matt, I hope you're watching this. He sends me these Loom videos like every week. They're like 3 minutes and they're so direct and to the point. He gets, because he fills out his check-in stuff and then he has the tabs open and he clicks through the tabs as he's talking about this feedback, showing me the check-in within like a 2.5 to 3 minute video. And I've basically looked over the entire check-in by the time I've listened to the Loom video. Like I could barely open his stuff. And like, I literally have his photos open, listen to the Loom video, and I pretty much know what I'm going to do by the time that he finishes it. But it's because it's direct. It's to the point. When he has something that comes up, he does kind of like you said with the dog sickness thing. Like, he doesn't go into this ramble. He just kind of, you know, walks me through what happened real quick. And it's beautiful, right? And so it's one way that like verbal for him allows him to speak concisely and clearly and get that across. Where like if he was having to write it, it would probably be 3-4 paragraphs or something much longer. So yeah, I think it's so valuable to have that option for them. But I do think the time limit aspect is important, because I've had it go south where it's like I've had 15-minute Loom videos or voice notes end up in my inbox, you know.
I think also like for the coach of like, okay, how do I start even implementing this is make one yourself. as a template example. So they have some learning to go off of. And I've done that with clients too. Mm-hmm. That way, like, they don't know what they don't know. So you need to show it to them. So it, maybe it's like your client, Matt, like, here's my example of where we can kind of what that should look like when you do it. Mm-hmm. And so they can start off on like a really good foot versus just giving them like the floor and the platform to like, just send the Loom video and like, man, who knows what you're going to get back? Cause they haven't done this before potentially. So I think setting up that example is really good. Anything else you want to hit on that before we move to the next point?
I just think it's a two-way street of communication is the last piece. And you need to have the self-awareness to understand how you communicate the best as well. I think how you send feedback is really important in that it starts with the client. So it starts the two-way street with the initiation of the client filling out the check-in and how well they do that. That's where that two-way street starts. But the return is how you communicate that check-in response back. And so I'm really big on, for me, I'm a verbal communicator. I do really well in like public settings of talking. And so the Loom video fits really well for me because it feels like I'm on the spot. I've got the video right there on me and then I'm talking and I just do well with that. Okay. And it just gets my points across. I get made fun of for the little sayings that I use within check-ins and it's fine and all my clients love it. And it's kind of like a running joke on the team, but it's how I clearly communicate back to them my expectation. And so it creates that culture a little bit better of two-way streets of communication and they know the expectation. I think that's just the last piece within communicating with clients that I make a lot of content on because I think it's what tells you whether a coach-client relationship is going to fail or going to flourish.
Yeah, it builds in that personal aspect that you need to a degree. And again, if we go back to look at what coaches do really good job, they all build some type of relationship with their athletes. So you understand a bit about that person. And I think I'm going to segue this into, it's actually the fourth point, but it's going to make us our third point because we're already bringing it up. And it's the worst coach out there is not invested. And I think giving those Loom videos back is one way to know that you are invested. Because the client, when you get a Loom video from your client, you can pick up on those emotional cueings and how body language and how they're speaking. They want that back from the coach as well. So I would almost be more pressed as a coach to make sure that you give that level of communication, probably the clearest level of communication. So an athlete doesn't for one ever misinterpret something, but also, you know, they can see when you're needing to be stern with them and, or even getting excited for them and pointing out things that are wins. And I know when, you know, I had a coach and I did a email line that said, man, you killed it this week. Like I could just read that and be like, hell yeah, that was enough, you know? It's you want to make your coach proud. Like it's kind of part of it, as a coach, you might think, oh man, you don't need to make me proud. I want you to be proud of yourself and what we do. But that is part of the way it is. Like people are buying into, you know, us as a team, as a unit of what we're doing together. So we want to build each other up. And that Loom video back is a great tool to be able to do and show excitement for your client and know, wow, hey, this took the time to send me this video and they can see that you're more invested in the client. I think, you know, another point along this about being invested that I see a lot with client, the coaches that are really good, however, they get really busy and they prioritize their top tier athletes and the other ones are not as much, is just response times. So it's like, you know, if you're trying to like, it's funny, like when I, okay, this is a personal story now that went that way. That was my only example that I had in my head. Like when I first started trying to date Renee, I'll say trying, I would text her and I would get nothing back till like the evening. I'm like, man, this girl is just not into me at all. Like, I'll see where this goes, you know? And I felt like, man, I was just some scrub. And it can be like that versus like, you know, the person you text right away, you get a response right back. You're like, oh man, I feel important to this person. The same thing goes with coaching. So I've had coaching responses that are like, well, yeah, my coach gets back to me like 3 days later. Some are a week later. And if you're a competitor with getting responses a week later, guys, this is a red flag. That should not be happening. Yeah. Life happens. You know, I think if you're in the off season, there's no like emergent changes that need to happen. There's not a 911 coach. How do I switch out my rice for potatoes? There's no emergencies, right? In what we're doing, peak weekend stuff is different. You know, it's very within reason, a 24 hour response time. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times for us, we might set that as, hey, that's our standard, just so we have some wiggle room. I usually tell my clients, if you don't hear from me in 24 hours, please, please reach out, because likely it was something, a technical issue. You know, an email didn't go through, it went to the junk folder or something like this. It's not because I forgot about you and I don't care about you. But most of the time, like, and Luke, you'll say this, right? Like, response times are probably within 6 to 12 hours. If not, they happen to be emailing you at the time that you're sitting down doing check-ins, and the response time's within minutes.
Yeah. So I typically do the 24 hour window. I do, for my sake, I set a timestamp for when they have to get check-ins submitted by, for same day response, because, just with how we, you know, we do things, I have blocks in which I do check-ins. Right. And so, I sit down to it all in front of me. I burn through all of the check-ins and make sure that everybody gets the responses. But then you get the 3 p.m. email from someone that's like, post your check-in block. It's like, you're going to get it tomorrow, man. Like, I'm sorry. It's within 24 hours, you know, but there's, because like that dynamic relationship, right? Like, how much you prioritize getting that check-in into me is like potentially could affect that response time. So I typically do the 24 hour, but most of the time it's within, you know, 6 to 8. It's same day, because they're, I would say 85% of my clients get it to me first thing in the morning. So it's just like right there sitting for me. I'm ready to roll with it and go from there. And then also too, as a coach, I think adjusting check-in schedules for international clients is a good way to keep that string of going back and forth huge. So like, I have like my check-in days that I tell my clients that I do check-ins on, but I always adjust it for all the people that I work with in Australia, right? Because if they send it to me, I'm getting it the night before, right? So if they send me a Monday morning check-in, I'm getting it Sunday night. So I tell them, hey, like if you send it Monday, I'll be hitting Australian clients first thing the morning of. And so I typically organize mine a little bit by time zone, or kind of where it is in my email. But I like to do it time zone because Australia is the furthest ahead on the client roster and kind of like Eastern Asia Eastern Asia, and then work back so that I'm doing it in the order that I'm receiving it in that manner.
Yeah, makes sense. And one thing I would mention for newer coaches is don't try to make your selling point that you're available anytime.
24/7.
No. And I, you know, we probably have all made that mistake of like, well, how do I up these other coaches with more experience? Well, I'll be more available. And you will shoot yourself in your foot, because how do you scale that up when then you get to the 20 client mark and then to the 50 client mark, and you have people messaging you at, like Luke said, 6 p.m. They're like, well, you said I would get a response within 24 hours, and people think within that daytime window.
Daytime.
Don't do it. Like, you need to respect your time and also plan out to where you can scale up your coaching business as well. Set those hard stops to like, hey, if it's not in by 12 p.m. this day, you'll hear back from the next business day, and then list out your business days when you do your check-ins. Yes. That way they, for one, it's going to show that you're wanted as a coach and your time is valuable, and you have that expectation set, and they know what to expect in turn. So it just keeps like a good boundary there and sets you up for success, to where you're not in the position where it, you know, if you give the mouse a cookie, the mouse wants a glass of milk, right? So once they are able to get a text back at 11 p.m. at night, they're going to expect that back. And another thing to be said around, you know, just upholding those expectations, be stern with your clients as well when you need to be. So we all have gotten the check-in, which then is an email, which then is a DM, which then is a WhatsApp and a text message. Hey, a client, hey, I checked in. Just want to make sure you got it on 5 different, you know, outlets. Don't even respond to any of the other ones. Or if I even get a response through, for you know, some clients might have my number. if it's coaching related, I go back to where we actually do coaching and said, hey, let's keep this all in one place for coaching related items and respond back through that medium. That way you can bring them back in a respectful way to what that expectation is and keep your clients on par that way. So all that shows that, for one, with timely check-ins, giving Loom videos back to where you can share your emotional, you know, excitement, upholding the expectations for your clients, not letting things slip, will just show that you're invested with them. And another thing about, and what we covered around training and just client check-ins, is not letting the expectations slip. And that just shows that you're kind of becoming complacent with that client, because clients become friends, right? And certain things that you would uphold with clients, like, hey, I want this training footage to happen. Then it stops happening. One video happens every now and then. Then all of a sudden we're not seeing training footage anymore. And then months go by. And it's like, well, that's just the way it is. And we just keep worrying. It's like, hell no, no. Set that expectation. Like, I'm invested in this client. This is what I require to coach you. My daily check-in logs, a lot of people start falling off. I said, hey, I have to have this to coach you to the best of my ability. If you want me to coach you to a lesser extent, that's going to happen if you don't do that. So uphold them. I don't care how long you coached them for. And that's one thing, like, I always have to revisit, is upholding my standard of what I want for my coaching and what I have to have my athletes giving back to show that I'm always invested.
Yep, I agree. I think that kind of covers like the investment piece. I think, again, another two-way street, right? Like, it's motivating as a coach to see a client extremely motivated about their process. And so it further buys into everybody. But one that I like, and I think this is our last point, because I think we kind of skipped on this one to jump to point four, is being a teacher. I think coaches have a role in athlete development. I've spoken about this a lot across various different platforms. Because I think that's probably where, for me, I kind of really thrive, is in that athlete development and that expectation upholding. And I think that opens the door to questions being asked, not only in regarding to their process, but you had made a post like of a client that had asked, how can I be better? I believe that was like a story you put up a couple weeks back, man. The amount of people that got their shit together on my roster after you put that up was wild. Because it's like, oh man, like, you know, I think it's just sometimes the wake up call is needed, right? And by being a teacher and like teaching them what does the next step of them being a better athlete look like, you can have these moments in time that actually level up the athlete's process. And I'm sure Josh won't care me using him. I think Josh has been a great example of this from when he started to where he's at now. A lot of the off season, the first off season we did together, while it was extremely productive and elevated him as an athlete development wise, there was a lot of off plan eating that was not overly adjusted for, potentially like estimated caloric intakes, but Chipotle's and things like that kind of just plugged into the plan where seen fit. Right. That translated into a prep where he struggled with food, like in adhering to the food in the contest prep setting. And, you know, there was a real conversation of like a teaching moment, like, hey, like you could learn from this. Like you could either let this be the trend that defines your athlete career, or you could learn from this and be a better athlete moving forward and like show them that path. And I think there's such value in that, because now he's having the most productive phases he's ever had as an athlete. But it's because the standard he's holding himself to is much higher. I mean, all it took was him going through that teaching moment of learning it the hard way. And sometimes it's the hard way of teaching someone, and sometimes it's catching it beforehand. But being a teacher is such a big aspect of being a coach.
It's funny you mentioned that. It just made me think of it kind of a different way, because there is a lot of people come in looking for even mentoring. Mm. And so I will touch on that. And let me loop back to it. But I think you're like a fun teacher in one capacity, but also you have to be the teacher that they might hate as well. It's mm-hmm. like the really mean sub that comes in, that like lays down the law. But for one, like the fun teacher is supposed to help build autonomy with their client. And autonomy is what's building like education and independence. So they feel like they have more control in their own daily process. They know what to do when things go wrong, and they end up enjoying it more because they know what to do. And enjoyment fosters results. I'll bring up Renee again. Renee got some roller skates. She's like wanted to roller skate and she put them on and oh my gosh, it was like watching a deer, you know, walk for the first time, like not doing anything, holding onto the railing. She's like, this is like really hard, frustrating. So she took some skating lessons and then like got the right cueing. Now she's like, she has a lot of fun. She wants to go out to the park and go roller skate. So it's like that for your client. Like if you never give them any instruction to actually enjoy it and have fun, it's going to be miserable the whole time. So I think there's that part of the fun teacher, but also Luke, what you brought up, if someone comes to you and they say, hey, John, I want a pro card. We're setting the bar to the ceiling. This is what that looks like. And I'll uphold you to that. So there's going to be a teaching component that they have no idea what that lifestyle might need to be to reflect trying to pursue a pro card. So there's going to be learning moments that are going to be hard learning moments that they might not want to hear and have a hard time executing, but will uphold them to that goal, which in turn is what they're asking for you too. Or if not, hey, we might need to reset what that goal is. So fun teacher, hard teacher. Back to my other point about when clients are coming in, what you should not be doing as a teacher is that you're also not a mentor, right? Go ahead. I'll let you speak to that because I'm sure people ask.
I think it can fit. It just has to be separated. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, you're paying for a coaching service to come in. That's the level that we need to operate at. If you're paying me to build a coaching business for you, that's different.
Yeah. And so I think that's the key distinction is there's certainly relationships in which I've done both, like coach them and mentored them, but they're very separate processes. And I actually bill separately for them to make that a very clear distinction so that they understand, like, in your point of like coaching a friend, like you're going to get text messages from your friends all the time, but if it has to do with the coaching process, you want it to be dropped into the coaching systems you're using. Same thing with the mentoring, right? Like, I think it's very clear delineation of what mentoring and coaching is. And look, you're going to learn a lot by coaching with anyone in that learning process of how they operate. But direct mentoring and helping build a business and helping you upscale your skills as a coach, that should be something that's completely separate from the coaching process, where the questions that are asked, you know, for learning should be about your athlete development within a coaching process. And then the questions that are asked within a mentoring process are going to be very long, very in-depth, very specific to what you're doing from a service perspective, where it's a completely different service all in and above.
Yeah, I think, you know, from a teaching aspect, from the coaching side, I remember a coach, he was, you know, client was kind of asking, you know, explaining why to do this refeed right now. And like, man, I'm not, I don't want to give away my coaching secrets of why I do these things. You're not paying me for that. Here's your plan. Just do it. And I think there's errors in that they're not, for one, going to steal like all your decision-making processes, but they need to know enough as the athlete to give the correct feedback. And so part of that autonomy process is making a client more introspective. So when they're doing this refeed that's happening, well, why am I doing it? Maybe know a little bit about that from an athlete level, and then what they should be monitoring to give that feedback back to the coach, you know, like, hey, what about, how's your training performance and stamina, or how is the digestive processes meal by meal? And through that, you can make an athlete more introspective, which is going to give better communication back. So they need to know a little bit of why were we doing things. So in turn, know what to be monitoring for when that variable is put into place. Now, the next step beyond that is a total full round decision making of when you're assessing an athlete, everything that's going on in the coaching mind and to a deeper level. And then everything we're going to be monitoring at a deep level in turn from that response back from the client. So like those definitely differentiate. There's a level to go to. And that's when you would be separating them out in your coaching business if you want mentorship or you want, you know, actual coaching work. So, but either way, there needs to be a degree of teaching happen for the athlete to develop and continue to improve.
Yeah, I don't know if I have a whole lot more to add to that.
No, I think that wraps it up. I mean, those are some really big areas that I've come across in in coaching that have fostered, like, you know, some of the best client relationships that I had, with good client communication, where I feel like I'm nearly walking alongside the client throughout the day. Like, that's the level of communication that I get back. I'm also seeing their training, so I know how the execution is. I've been able to teach them. I see them grow in that capacity, and seeing them excited, invested in the process, it only makes me more invested in the process. And it's just honest, right? Think about anything that you do. Like, if you're listening to this and you don't coach and you just have a job, and if your boss is excited for you and invested for you, it makes you feel good, right? But if you're like not giving back to your coach, right? If you do the one sentence line email, you don't send your training footage, if you don't seem excited about your own process, how would you expect the coach to be? They're not going to be. And do you think you're going to get back the same amount of time as that athlete that's excited, that fully invests in themselves and gets back to a coach? You won't. So a lot of times you need to make sure that, you know, ask yourself daily, and that goes back to that point I made, is like, how do I get better? Like, don't put it all in your coach to do it, because they can't just hold your hand. That's not what we're here for. So you do need to challenge your own self and say, how can I be better? And then ask your coach that, because if you don't know, ask. So if you eventually you get complacent, you feel comfortable in your coaching process as an athlete, you might not be improving. So constantly challenge yourself as an athlete, but if you're coaching others, also challenge yourself as a coach. Am I doing everything I can in this coaching process to make my athletes better? Has things fallen short? Well, what can I do to keep improve? Go through the four tips that Luke and I laid out, as these might be areas that you don't have currently in your process. Start implementing at least one or two, build it up from there, and see how the results change for your clients. And if you want a coaching process that is set up like this, Luke and I have wanted to coach the entire world. We can coach everyone. That'd be great. Eventually, it's just we can't, right? So, yeah. And we have been coaching coaches through J3 University. So a natural evolvement is that some of these coaches that we have coached have been phenomenal, and they are so hungry and invested in athlete processes and learning to be the best coach that they can, that we wanted them to be part of J3U. And that's why we launched J3U coaching, and to have them on board, so we can now spread out that coaching message that we have through others to grow and become even bigger. Mm-hmm. So Luke, if you want to add anything on about J3U coaching.
Yeah, no, I think it's, as you know, this is kind of like a passion project of mine, is anything to do with just like the ins and out of actually coaching people. Right. And, I'm emotional here. It's something that, like, I saw as our opportunity to try to perfect the craft of coaching and scale the impact in which we had. And I think, you know, the lines that we use to kind of help describe this is, the perfect mixture of, you know, anecdote and education, where all of these coaches are going through the courses and understanding this to the level of depth that we expect them to. And on top of that, mentoring with me every week and having hour and a half long conversations with these coaches to go through their clients and making sure that they're understanding the application portion of the process and fixing problems when it's stuff that's a little bit more complex. It's like real life coaching alongside the education of understanding the stuff that we've put out from an education content level, that I'm really excited for the impact that it's going to leave. And I think it's our next step in leaving this coaching industry better than we found it. And I couldn't believe in the team more than I do. And I think I'm just really passionate about it.
Yeah. If for anyone who wants to learn more about J3U coaching, we'll leave the link down below if you're watching on YouTube. Yeah. And also, if you're just a coach that wants to level up, we will have our level 2 J3U physique coach credential coming out very soon as well too, which goes back to not just being like what you might have learned if you went through our level 1, where it's a lot of theoretical, you're learning the 101 on a lot of things, information based. Level 2 is all case study work, 100%. It's Luke and I walking through all of our clients, our decision processes and making challenging you to make the decisions along with us. So it's truly the next step up. And then also being able to get a credential that we feel strongly would be representative of the level that we want of a coach coming out of J3U. So that's also to come out very soon. We'll leave a link down below to learn more and also have our launch of the J3U PC. But anyway, thank you everyone for tuning in, and we will talk to you next time.